Hey folks, Weingart here, and this is an MCrit Wii. Today, I discuss with PoemCrit maven, master of all things resuscitation and critical care, Josh Farkas, a guest post he recently placed on the PoemCrit blog. Now, you know, the way things work is we're all a collective of independent blogs joined together on one site. So I do not know what's coming from any of the other site editors until the moment it posts. So I got to read this in real time with you. And I was a little bit scared about the tone. I disagree with a lot of the clinical stuff, but I think in the right patient group, it is not that the ideas have some merit. I would just do things a little differently, but I think the way it was written may make you think they're talking about an entirely different group. So I wanted to get Josh on the line and talk it through. And as usual, we wound up agreeing on most of the things. I'm not sure if the original poster, Dr. Stemp, will agree. I'm curious to hear what he has to say. I talk about a lot of the stuff I mentioned in podcast 15, and then maybe even more fun for people that have already listened to podcast 15 is at the bottom of that, I have a link to a discussion I had with one of my former teachers who is a pulmonary intensivist, Lewis Rubinson, and that added some additional nuance. But I think the key thing I want to get across, and I do mention it within the podcast, but I just wanted to take a second now, is what I think is a I know it's prevalent, and I think it is a myth, which is this idea that the pathophysiology of asthma is they can't exhale very easy. And this is what we all learn in textbooks. This is what we were taught in medical school. And I think a lot of treatment is being predicated on this, which is fine, because that is the predominant problem for asthma until it gets to the point of what I define as a crashing patient, which is means they're at the end of their rope, they look horrible, they are barely moving any air, and their lung sounds are like absent or barely there, and you're just like, oh my gosh, this patient's going to get intubated or crap out, or you know, we don't want this to happen, but or die. You know, if I don't do major stuff in the next 15 minutes, and in these patients, for the vast predominance of the ones I see these days. Maybe it's different in like more rural environments where there's not much access to primary care, or maybe if you're in a different country where there's no asthma care, the percentages may be different. But in these patients, the problem is an inhalation problem. And if you really start looking, you'll see, and you could prove this to yourself, is these patients, they're just not moving any gas. And it's because it is harder to inhale against their inflated chest. To some extent, that's part. But the big part of the problem is just exhaustion. These patients have respiratory muscle fatigue, exacerbated by hypercarbia, the acidotic milieu, and they probably, by the stage you're seeing them, might even be hypoxemic just because they're not moving enough gas. And therefore, that's going to make things still worse. It starts affecting their mental status. And so these patients just are not moving any gas. And you could prove this. You put them on end-tidal, there's no significant end-tidal waveform. And then even though they're breathing 60 times a minute, you put them on non-invasive, they're just not moving anything more than dead space ventilation levels of gas. And therefore, these patients just need to get their CO2 down and their oxygen up. And if you did any number of things, if you put them on a non-invasive machine with BiPAP, with inspiratory pressure, all of a sudden their tidal volumes get high and the cycle reverses, or if you bag them. And what you'll find in both of these things is their pressures are not particularly high. You could bag them easily. They're not difficult to bag, which would be, you know, what the classic example of asthma that we all talk about from medical school would be, which is these patients who are so overinflated and so unable to exhale that they're already have enormous pressure in their chest, and you try to push in with your BVM and you're not able to. I've seen those patients. I haven't seen them for many years, but those are not what you're seeing with crashing asthma. In those patients, sure, their problem is they can't inhale or exhale, but the predominant issue with most of the crashing asthmatics you see is simply that they've reached the point where they can't get any gas in themselves, but if you help them, there's nothing stopping that gas from going in. They're not particularly hard to bag. Yes, they have a slightly longer exhalatory period. You got to give them time, but it's not significant. It is not like these stone chest asthmatics. And okay, so I just wanted to flesh that out because a lot of my comments are predicated on that difference between what you see in the textbook and what actually exists for crashing asthmatics, which really they are only seen by EMS and by ED physicians for the most part. You will not generally see these patients at other points in the hospital course. And so very much like acute pulmonary edema, if you are not in this field, then you are not seeing these patients and you may be giving care recommendations that don't apply to these patients. All right, let's get to it. Josh and I, this is about a 45-minute discussion and I think you'll enjoy it. And if you don't, then put it in the comments section. So, Josh, I read a post on MCRIT today. It was a guest post on the PulmCRIT section of the site. You might know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's a new concept for asthma. Basically, we're going to smother everyone with a pillow until their PCO2 goes up, and then they stop breathing, and everything will be perfect.
Well, I mean, the cuckoo's nest strategy is not that far away from what was actually advocated. So I wanted to get you on the line to talk about some of the clinical stuff. But before we do, I gotta voice my concern about this post. And I will do it in the perspective of contrasting it with a normal PulmCrit post. Now, Josh, both you and I traditionally have put out a lot of stuff that may be cutting edge, that may look to others as somewhat crazy. But I think both of us do it in a tone of, here's the evidence for what I have. If there is no evidence, understand this is my practice. This is the best conglomeration of everything out there that I could come up with. But if it's not supported by evidence, you make that clear. And you're always very humble in your tone. It was one of the reasons that I just gravitated towards everything you write, is you have bleeding edge ideas and an incredible degree of equanimity and humility. Now, all the things I said, I think, are antithetical to this post. What is your response to this, Josh?
You know, I think people should definitely understand that this post is absolutely a bleeding edge post. The ideas are put out there for the purpose of discussion, so we can talk about them as we're going to talk about them now. But really, none of this is established science or defines law, so to speak.
Okay, fair enough. And I think if I had read like a proviso to that, to saying that at the beginning, it might have alleviated the dread by which I read this and then just envisioned the amount of emails, because I get all the emails initially and then they get forwarded on that go to the MCRIT site. And I just know people are going to be like, this is exactly what's wrong with foam, is primarily eminence-based ideas predicated on physiology presented in a way to brook no possibility of being wrong. And we really strive in foam to go with a true identification of what is evidence-based and what is practice-based, with the latter being perfectly acceptable so long as they are identified as such.
I agree. And I think one thing that you may be seeing here is anytime someone is used to conversation in a certain context and then they move to a different context, there may be something lost in translation. For example, like on Twitter, I think there are people who kind of tweet and understand the norms of Twitter. And then sometimes like other people enter the conversation who aren't familiar with the norms, and that causes confusion. I think the same thing happens in foam sometimes, where there's like a body of people who are consistent with the way that we communicate on foam. And then, you know, I think other times, you know, other folks get involved in the conversation who aren't quite, you know, involved in those norms. And one thing that you realize when you write a blog is how many different opinions there are out there. And no matter how firmly you believe in something, there's someone out there who believes the exact opposite with equal strength. And that makes you kind of try to bring folks together to the greatest amount possible. And that's, you know, that takes time.
Yeah. As a spark for conversation, the post is amazing. I mean, that's what the conversation we're going to have right now. So from that perspective, if nothing else to get people talking, I think it's really interesting. I think there'll be a little more nuance after you and I discuss as to whether you should adopt these things specifically to your practice and when to do so. I guess that brings up the first question I had about this post, which wasn't really identified, which is exactly which patients are we talking about here? Because that's always my fear for foam is, you know, studies, even review articles make a very distinct encircling of who they're talking about. Now, when you read this post, Josh, you know, it was sent to you as a guest post. Is this in your mind ED patients? Is this critical care patients that have already been screened by an ED and been sick enough to get to an ICU? What were you envisioning when you put this out there?
So my envisioning is really a patient who probably rolls into the emergency department, is really doing poorly, you know, very, very tachypneic, agitated, not really able to comply with the BiPAP mask. And that kind of patient where you're tempted to kind of dissociate them with ketamine and go down that route, but maybe not quite that sick. And you want to kind of calm them down, get them to breathe more slowly, get them to tolerate the BiPAP mask. I think a key point here is that the concept of using fentanyl is really probably most useful initially within the first like 5, 10, 15 minutes of therapy. And I think I would see that almost more as a bridge to, you know, adding on additional therapies. And probably in my practice, I would see this as a bridge to dexmedetomidine, which I really like a lot for these patients. And I think is probably in some ways safer and more idiot proof.
See, I was hoping you weren't going to say that because a lot of the stuff in here, I think would have been very applicable to a slightly worse than normal presentation to the ED. You know, the patient who is, they're not crashing. They're not the so severe that intubation would even enter your mind. They're just not responding that great to just albuterol and steroids. And if you had said that, I think a lot of my trepidation about the things we're talking about would be, I still might not necessarily agree, but I think they would be very, very reasonable things. Now, when you tell me that what you're envisioning and what potentially by, you know, secondary translation Leo is envisioning is the patient who comes into the emergency department about to be intubated, looking like crap, then most of the things said here, I think, are not just disagreeable to me, but I think flatly dangerous. But let's talk about them from the context of the patient you're envisioning and see how they hold. And then maybe at the end, my point of these might be applicable to a different patient population may come to light. I'm so reluctant to even make these, to ask this question, yet it has to be asked because the first podcast ever on MCRIT was on sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema. And it was to address something that I finally boiled over with misery and rage to the point where I just had to have a platform. And that was just these management of these super sick crashing acute pulmonary edema patients that I was being instructed with no shortage of arrogance and meanness to how to take care of them by the cardiologists. And the thing was, the cardiologists had probably never seen these patients before. And if they had, they were very few and far between because there's no way they could see them because they either were intubated, which changes the entire pathophys of acute pulmonary edema, or they were already better enough to have cardiologists come to the bedside. Now, I'm sure there were cardiologists that saw these patients at arrival because they were walking by the doorway or some other weird circumstance. But for the most part, the therapies they told me I had to do, like Lasix, and the therapies they told me I couldn't do, like high-dose nitroglycerin, were exactly what the patients needed. And so the question I guess I have to ask is, Leo, who is either an anesthesiologist or an intensivist or both, where is he seeing this patient you're envisioning?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And honestly, like the crashing asthmatic patients, like the really bad ones, this is increasingly rare. Yep. Just in general.
Absolutely right.
You know, as far as like intubated asthmatic patients, like only see a handful of these a year. We're talking about kind of a zebra to begin with. We will see patients who are tight and bronchospastic in the ICU, but that's a totally fair, you know, to
and
point
that's
out.
The patient I think this works on. Exactly right. You know, the patients who are maybe in the ICU, not intubated, who are not crashing sick. I think everything in this post and your point, which I think maybe we're talking about the same group, dexmedetomidine is only going to work on a patient who is sick but not crashing.
Yeah. You know, to try to flesh this out a little bit, in my mind, I think there's a range of severity. So as you get more and more severe, so like for that patient who comes in and they're not doing great, but they're not doing horribly, who you kind of mentioned earlier, I think most of those patients will do fine on a dexmedetomidine infusion. You put them on BiPAP, you calm them down on dexmedetomidine. That whole process takes like 45 minutes or 60 minutes. It takes a while, but the patient's not like, you know, bursting into flames.
Yes.
Then, you know, and then I think that there might be a small sliver as your severity increases, a little small sliver of patients where you need something to give them while you're waiting for the Precedex to kind of kick in, to kind of buy you a little bit of time to calm them down, to settle things down for like 20 or 30 or 40 minutes while you're waiting for that dexmedetomidine level to increase. Because I don't know about you, but I basically never bolus people with Precedex.
Yep, I don't either.
I've heard horror stories about it.
I've experienced the horror stories.
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, so there's dexmedetomidine monotherapy. As you increase in severity, you could add a little fentanyl before your Precedex. And then in the absolute crashing patient, maybe we're kind of using that term in a different way. That, I think, would potentially be your ketamine dissociation.
Yep. Okay. So I think we're on the same page now. And I think a lot of this post is better now. So let's, for the purpose of this discussion, break our two patients of relevance to this discussion into two groups. We'll call them severe asthma, and we'll call them patients who could wait 45 to 60 minutes while you get therapies going to the level you want, whether it be fentanyl titration, dexmedetomidine, working on CPAP, what have you. And then we'll have a group we'll call crashing. And those are the patients that will wind up with a tube or dead if you do not fix them in the next 15 minutes.
Fair.
Okay. So then in my mind, fentanyl for a crashing patient is the worst thing you could possibly do. Because these patients already are on the brink of death. And giving them a respiratory depressant to take control of the situation and titrating that up. Just as Dr. Stemp said, this takes a while sometimes. It's not instant acting in these patients. And you don't have that time. And you don't take control of the situation. And you don't differentiate into the two groups of crashing asthmatics. And this lack of differentiation, I think, was the major miss in this post, because this was a post almost primarily driven by physiology. And this post, at least in my experience, misses the major portion of the crashing asthmatic physiology. And I could say that it misses it by the fact that in numerous places in boldface, it says the problem with asthma is that they can't exhale.
You disagree with that?
Oh, I disagree vociferously. I think I could walk you guys through it, you and Dr. Stemp by proxy, to understand why. When you take a crashing asthmatic, for the most part, their problem is that due to their overinflation, their respiratory acidosis, their muscle fatigue, they actually are doing dog panting respiration. They are doing dead space ventilations. And you could easily prove this to yourself if you ever get to see another crashing asthmatic. And these are patients who, while they are breathing at 60 times a minute, are moving no gas whatsoever. And the way you prove it to yourself is the way you alluded to in your post, Josh. You can either put them on non-invasive and see what tidal volumes they're actually pulling, and they're minimal. Or you can put them on end-tidal CO2 and see that they're generating very little end-tidal CO2 waveform, because even though they're breathing, they're not actually getting any gas. Now, you might say, well, that could still be, Scott, because they can't exhale, right? Because if you are so overinflated you can't exhale, then you won't be able to inhale, and that's the problem, if we could just get that gas out. And yeah, there are a few asthmatics that present that way. I haven't seen one in 12 years. I did before that at a place where there was no treatment for asthma in the community, and you still saw those stone chest asthmatics, the ones where even when you paralyzed them, you still had a like stand on their chest to get the gas out. I don't see that anymore. These patients, the second you were to dissociate them with ketamine or do something to chill them out, they have no problem expiring. They don't have a particularly extended expiratory period. I mean, it's longer than maybe your normal patient, but they are not a patient. BVM off the end of the tracheal tube, and they just exhale for 20 seconds. Those patients are very, very rare. But the patients who are crashing because they no longer have enough respiratory musculature due to acidosis and fatigue to actually pull in a breath, those I see not uncommonly. And those patients need inhalation, not exhalation. And those patients, if you were to bag them, as pre-ops for intubation, have no problem bagging. There's no squeezing the bag and like with two hands. And I had some of those asthmatics, like I say, 12, 15 years ago. I haven't seen one of those in a long, long, long time. So no, at the very end, in most patients, inhalation becomes the problem. Now, exhalation might have had a portion of the contribution to that, but that is not the main pathophysiology. And if you could just get them breathing, two things happen instantly. Well, one instantly and the second one relatively quickly, which is their oxygen saturations increase and their CO2 begins to go down, which markedly offloads their respiratory muscle. Now, you know, Dr. Stemp was talking about the fact that you should monitor their pulse ox without O2 on. The problematic aspect of that is you're waiting for them to become severely hypoxic. That's in these crashing asthmatics a prelude to them dying.
Yeah, I think, you know, pragmatically speaking, all these patients are going to have nasal cannula oxygen on. And in that context, you can't really use the oxygen saturation to monitor ventilation. So I agree with you. You can't go off the saturation.
Well, I'd go a step further because at this stage, at least in my own head, we're still talking about crashing patients. These patients should have 100% or close to it FiO2 because, again, if they are crashing, you may have to intubate these patients at any moment. The way we monitor their respiratory drive is, just as you said in your post, by end tidal, which is a much better marker than room air saturation SATs to measure respiratory drive, and the non-invasive machines, very carefully calibrated measurements of their respiratory. So there's no reason to leave these patients off of oxygen. So then the question becomes, would you, Josh, in the patient I'm describing as crashing, use fentanyl as your agent?
So here's the question. So I think we can begin with common ground, which is that the patient needs to get on non-invasive ventilation. They need support, and they're probably going to do a lot better if they can get on that. And I think the question is how to achieve that. So really, I think the question here is fentanyl versus ketamine.
Yep.
And this is challenging for me because the evidence basis for both of these drugs is like non-existent.
Yep.
So it's really, really tough. I think both drugs have a lot going for them. You know, ketamine is going to get you there faster. I mean, it's like one circulatory, you know, 30 seconds after you push it, the patient's going to be dissociated, has bronchodilatory properties. So as far as stabilizing your patient in the next 90 seconds or 120 seconds, that's ketamine. That's like really the only way to do it. What makes me a little nervous about ketamine is, you know, there's not a lot of evidence, and I'm always a little nervous that, you know, as the patient is like waking up from a ketamine haze, they're going to vomit into their BiPAP mask. And I realize that ketamine doesn't cause emesis while it's given, but at some point it needs to wear off. I must admit, that's my main concern about ketamine.
That's a super valid concern. I mean, I guess we're jumping ahead in the post, but I think it's worthwhile. This is a very fortuitous place to discuss it. Naysaying about ketamine in the post that was predicated solely on in my clinical practice. I don't know. I live with an anesthesiologist. I'm not sure how much ketamine is used in Dr. Stemp's practice. It could be far more than I'm familiar with in the anesthesiologist I'm aware with. But even if it is, I promise you that the clinical practice of a 2019 emergency doc gives far more familiarity with ketamine than anesthesia. Now, you, Josh, may be one of the few intensivists that have a big practice with ketamine. Most of the intensivists in the United States are not using it as predominantly. This medication is insanely safe. Like, there's nothing else. There is nothing else. Like, to even put fentanyl up against it in terms of apnea would be laughable. In adults, I can't speak to kids, but and I know you're not saying this, Josh, I just want to get these points out here. So ketamine's not going to stop them breathing, but it might, because I have to say that because there was, one patient in a case report and then one patient reported to me and not published that I know of. So, we say the same thing we say with DSI, which is if you're going to give ketamine, you're prepared to intubate before you give the ketamine. So, and you're watching them, you can't leave the room, you can't go anywhere else, but they won't stop breathing. They'll stop breathing for 15 seconds if you push it too fast. And after that, they won't stop breathing. It just as you say, does not cause emesis during its actual dissociation, at least in adults. Laryngospasm is a very rare possibility in adults. Again, case reportable, but it's possible. So again, be ready to intubate. It's definitely possible, as opposed to apnea, which I've yet to see. And it's so scant as to be almost, I don't know if it was.
I've seen it once.
The apnea or the laryngospasm?
Laryngospasm.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, although I provoked it by doing a bronchoscopy. So.
Yep, and my case of laryngospasm was in a pediatric TEE case. So it's definitely possible. It's out there. It will usually respond to positive pressure, but understand it's a possibility. Now, the emesis on emergence is the one to be wary of if you're not going to intubate them. And so you're absolutely right. These patients need to be watched. If you're really scared, Josh, then just put them on a nasal BiPAP mask and assign someone to hold their mouth closed. And you will get most of the advantages, but we usually don't. We usually just keep them on the standard and we just watch them carefully because you'll know when they're waking up. There will be a good period of them going, oh, before they start puking. I've never seen someone wake up to puke. There's always a good 2-3 minutes of emergence. The only way you get screwed is when they don't treat this with the monitoring you really need to. So we tell our people, hey, and it's actually true. This is a procedural sedation. And as soon as you say that, then they're forced, obliged, as you know, to sit there with a ridiculous piece of paper or the computer and chart vital signs every 3 minutes. And they're not allowed to leave the room. Our poor nursing colleagues I'm talking about, of course. And then all of a sudden, someone is forced to watch the patient. And so you've put your finger on the one that, you know, you have to be wary of. Okay, so, but the benefit is this patient only gets better in 15 minutes. That's what we're defining as crashing. So I don't know if fentanyl titration in that patient, by which I mean they're so sick that you have the laryngoscope prepped and ready to go, if I would give fentanyl. Now, if we go with what we call the severe group, the one I think you're talking about for this post, for dexmedetomidine, et cetera, I think fentanyl is a beautiful idea. I totally agree with Dr. Stemp. I think he's absolutely right. I think this is the agent. I think you and I have independently declared our love of fentanyl for BiPAP patients who are agitated or not tolerating it or their respiratory rate's too high. I think all three of us agree if we define it as a non-crashing patient. Is that fair so far?
Totally fair.
Okay, and I love your dexmedetomidine idea, and I love the idea of bridging them with a little fentanyl to dexmedetomidine. I think this is great if we're talking about a less than crashing group. Now, my question to you, Josh, is my way of thinking about these patients is always they just need to CTFO, right? So chill the frack out. And if you get them chill, I don't care if it's 22, 21, 24. How committed are you to this 15 to 20?
It's just, people make numbers. When you write a textbook, you realize that like 75% of the numbers in a textbook are just completely made up. So I think if it's over like 25 to 30, that would make me definitively unhappy. But I don't think the patient's going to like explode if their respiratory rate is, you know, in the low 20s.
Absolutely.
Usually, I feel like, you know, when you get them on dexmedetomidine and they fall asleep and they can kind of doze off, oftentimes, you know, the respiratory rate will usually drift into like the mid-teens. And I feel like that makes me really happy. That's a patient who's going to do super well.
That, see, I think you've put your finger on my real question in my mind, which is if they CTFO, their respiratory rate goes down. And if we give meds to get their respiratory rate down, they CTFO. And I don't know which of the two really matters. My inkling, my belief is once they chill out, they get better. You could fix an asthmatic when we were in the outward bound, the way you had to deal with an asthmatic when you didn't have any medication is you had to have them mirror your respiratory rate and you just brought them down. And yeah, their respiratory rate came down, but they also chilled out. And so because I don't know, you know, this is where the evidence-free zone comes, but I think we all agree they need to chill out and they need to lower their respiratory rate. And I don't know if the exact numbers are those are the ones, but I do agree with both of you that you got to give them something to chill out if they're unchill. And now this is my last objection to this piece is I have some asthmatics who were breathing 22, 23, 24, 28, sitting there calmly in bed, I would never think to treat them at all. They are doing fine. If they're relaxed, then they are exhaling. I can't even imagine the circumstance I would take a resting comfortably in bed, smiling, talking to me, you know, pulling off the albuterol to speak on their cell phone for 3 minutes. And you look at their respiratory rate and it's 32. I would never treat that patient with non-invasive or fentanyl.
You know, I must admit, if the respiratory rate was really in the 30s, I'd be tempted to try them on BiPAP just to see if I could decrease their respiratory rate. I agree with you. I wouldn't give them fentanyl because I'd be concerned that they might fatigue out eventually. But I agree with you. I mean, ultimately, these, you know, decisions are all clinical and yep. depending on how the patient
looks. It's how they look. Absolutely right. Yeah. All right. Let's get to the real, I think, contradiction to evidence zone, which is the choice of non-invasive mode.
Oh, God.
Because thankfully, this has actually been studied. There was a period of time where CPAP was readily available and BiPAP wasn't. And there was all these trials of, and so CPAP was okay. And then BiPAP was better. And the reason, ostensibly, is that these patients need help, in my mind, getting breaths in, the ones I use non-invasive on. And there's no putative reason to think CPAP helps them exhale. CPAP makes it harder to breathe out. And now you're going to talk about stenting. Asthmatics don't have stenting issues. That's why I say get rid of the COPD. Yes, I'm happy to have the debate of how what people keep them stented, what people make it. Yes, that's why let's just not talk about COPD. Asthmatics don't have stenting issues. Where are their stenting issues?
Well, aside from the stenting, you know, there is auto PEEP, and I think, you know, giving them some PEEP can help them trigger the BiPAP. But I think we're basically in agreement here. I think I'm actually 100% in agreement with you, which is that, you know, the PEEP provides some benefit. It helps them trigger. It offsets their auto PEEP. And then, you know, giving them support on top of the PEEP with the BiPAP, you know, mechanically supports them and it prevents them from fatiguing and helps them breathe. So I think we're completely in agreement on this. And honestly, this is a bit of a frustrating topic for me because I encounter, like, really, really smart people who will say, like, PEEP is crap and all you need is, you know, the ventilatory support and everyone should be on like 15/0. And then I'll find other people who say that, like, PEEP is the only thing that's important and everyone should just be on CPAP at 10. And it's just like, you know, I'm kind of just in the middle of the road. I think both are good.
Okay. Well, my concern is that there's conflation going on, not on your part, but in this, you know, broad-based audience, between what to set a ventilator for mechanically ventilated COPD and asthmatic on, PEEP, no PEEP, versus non-invasive. And my non-invasive patients never have problems triggering. You know, that's not an issue on these patients that I have ever seen. I've never seen them struggling to make the non-invasive give them a breath. They're still at the stage where they are generating more than adequate capability of triggering. And I've just never seen this as an issue. Now, what I have seen is, and everyone should do these tests. I mean, if you haven't, as an intensivist or resuscitation doctor, experienced what these devices actually feel like, then how can you put them on your patients? And breathing out against CPAP is less than enjoyable. And I'm not sure what the even the physiologic rationale is for why CPAP would be better than BiPAP for asthmatics. And then I mean, now we have to move into the obstructive diseases as a category, but the evidence for BiPAP, you know, this is the number one indication for non-invasive is BiPAP for COPD patients. And now I'm conflating them with asthmatics, which I just accused, you know, the audience out there of. But in terms of the evidence base, you know, because both COPD and asthma were mentioned in the post, this is settled like decades ago. There was not even a intimation of why CPAP was better. It's simply that it was better. There wasn't even a rationale in the post for why you would ever put these patients on CPAP, except for your comments, Josh. That was at least the only attempt to mention why. So I don't understand. And maybe Dr. Stemp, I'm sure Dr. Stemp will write back with comments on everything this post has said. But at least I'd love to understand the physiologic rationale. There's just no reason I could see why CPAP is a good idea. And then the clinical experience is a no-brainer. There's no reason not to think it. We have studies from, I think, the 80s that showed CPAP was okay, BiPAP was a little bit better, but it will work. And I don't even know what we're doing, aside from medicalizing the whole situation and giving them a additional bonus for their inspiration. That's all we're doing. And the reason CPAP does that is CPAP is holocycle, right? It's both inspiratory and expiratory. It's essentially a hairdryer in your mouth during inspiration and expiration. And I think it's the hairdryer in your mouth during inspiration that changes these patients' perception of air hunger, muscle fatigue, and misery. And most of them will be able to exhale. Now, the only confounder to everything we've spoken about is the stone chest asthmatic, right? And Josh, when's the last time you saw one of these? The ones you have to go on VV ECMO because you can't even get their CO2 down. Like the permissive hypercapnia goes to 200. I mean, I remember some of these patients.
I had one a couple months ago, but they're super rare.
Yes, they're super rare. But everything I've said does not apply to those patients. BiPAP won't work on those patients. That's not their problem of inhalation. Their problem is you can't inhale or exhale. Ketamine's not going to fix those, the bronchodilatory effect of ketamine, which I don't value at all. I want to make that clear. I think I agree with Dr. Stemp on this one. And I think you, Josh, as well. The people like saying, oh, ketamine changed their entire, you know, they were bronchospastic and dying, and then they were better. No, you chilled them the F out, and that's why they're better. And they started breathing again. I am unimpressed with ketamine's bronchodilatory effects.
That's an interesting. So I agree with you for the crashing patient. The benefit that you get is anxiolysis, or probably the wrong terminology, but whatever, dissociation, they chill out. That's the goodness there. I am interested in the use of high-dose ketamine infusion for the intubated asthmatic who you're having difficulty ventilating. And
I agree. I do it there because whatever you get, it's bonus.
Exactly.
Though I would love to see a head-to-head of propofol and ketamine, and it doesn't have to be patient-oriented outcome. We could just do with markers on the vent of bronchospasm, because I'm curious to see which one actually has more bronchodilatory effects.
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you which one will hurt the hemodynamics worse.
Yeah, that goes without saying. So I wonder if the post is not a conflation of two patient groups and two asthma subtypes, because a lot of the post feels to me like it's severe but not crashing, in which case I agree with almost all of it. And some of the post feels to me like it's conflating the stone chest asthmatic with the asthmatics I see very commonly that still look like garbage. And I just can't make this clear enough. They still appear to be crashing asthmatics because they are flailing about and they are breathing at 60 and they are ripping off everything because they are feeling like they're dying. But what I found is when you give those patients ketamine, non-invasive or not, they look like $1 million. And then the non-invasive is what makes them better. And when you take a stone chest asthmatic and gave them ketamine, nothing gets better. Or maybe you're causing the slightest little chipping away at the horribleness of their bronchospasm. But most of my crashing asthmatics are not severely bronchospastic. They are bronchospastic. There's definitely wheezing. But the reason when you listen to their chest, it's near silent, is not because they can't get the air in and out if you were to push it in and out. It's because they themselves can't get the air in and therefore have nothing to exhale.
I think ultimately, our visions here are almost identical. And I think some of the language has been different. And I'll try to clarify this in, you know, the IBCC chapter, as far as like, hopefully I'll break this down into a couple of groups and have some pictures. And I think at the end of the day, we'll be in agreement.
I think we usually are when I've spoken to you about this stuff in the past on asthma. Now, I guess the last thing to discuss, and you talked about some of the controversy in your post, is once they're actually intubated, whether they're on a pressure control mode or a volume control mode. And let me put forth my stance on all mechanical ventilation. For most intents and purposes, there is no difference between a pressure control mode and a volume control mode. They are doing the same thing. It's always a trade-off of what you get to monitor and what you get to force. That is the only difference between those two modes. And I can make most things work on either a pressure control or a volume control mode. Most things. There are a few things where pressure control is absolutely necessary, like when you need to extend the inspiratory time for the amount of time they spend during in a breath, aka APRV, or just extending out their eye time, et cetera. But other than that, they're the same. And then the question is, what are the trade-offs? And we're just talking about pressure control and volume control. We have to talk about pressure support in a sec, because that just strikes me as crazy. But the problem with a pressure control mode is you are giving slow breaths. You're almost obliged to be giving slow breaths. And that just seems counter to what I want to accomplish. Now, the problem with volume control modes is that you have to look at the machine and make sure they are not breath stacking and horrible stuff is going on. Then they're not increasing their plateau pressures. And so one way or the other, there's a trade-off. Now, which trade-off you choose is up to you. But the problem with pressure control is you might get incredibly low tidal volumes. And therefore, that's also dangerous in and of itself if you're not carefully monitoring them. What do you think, Josh?
I think once you intubate the asthmatic patient, the game changes entirely. So, you know, beforehand, you're trying to do everything possible to keep them off the vent. Now they're intubated. The intubated asthmatic patient is basically almost never going to die from hypercapnia unless you're doing everything backwards. I mean, in a modern good ICU, I think that should really just, I mean, that's just not the way people die. I'm sure we've all seen cases and heard about cases where the PCO2 goes to whatever crazy high numbers and everyone's freaked out about it. And like the end of the story is always like the patient goes home and everything's fine. So like, I think hypercapnia in the intubated asthmatic patient is really a paper tiger. Everyone freaks out about it. It's not what kills people and it's not what we should be worried about. So I think the bottom line for the intubated asthmatic is they're going to break. They all break eventually. And what we need to do is keep them alive and essentially just avoid complications. So it's like the pneumothorax, the vent-associated pneumonia, like PE, like those are the things that are potentially going to kill them. Otherwise, I think all, you know, so from that standpoint, like if the patient's, for example, like if they're on pressure control mode and suddenly their tidal volume drops in half and their PCO2 goes from 60 to 100 or 120, like that's not great, but it's probably not going to kill them and it's probably not going to cause harm. Whereas if they're in a volume cycled mode and suddenly their pressure shoots super high and they get a big pneumothorax with bronchopleural fistula, that's a disaster. That's a patient you may not be able to ventilate. You might need to ECMO, you know. So given a choice between, you know, a pressure cycled mode where, you know, maybe I may hypoventilate the patient, but I'm less likely to cause barotrauma versus a volume cycled mode where I have guaranteed volume, you know, of ventilation, but I could cause, you know, pneumothorax or could cause barotrauma, I'd rather err on the side of not caring about the PCO2.
And that's fair, but what eye time are you putting these patients on?
You know, I think, you know, you could theoretically use like a pretty high, you know, inspiratory pressure, and then your eye time is going to be like 0.8 or 1 second. So it's probably,
you might could, be a little theoretically, bit, yeah. But are you, is my question. Cause absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then that's fair. I don't think most people are. I think most people are keeping a very low PC setting and therefore missing the boat on this mode. But yes, if you're putting a short eye time and a high pressure control, then it's exactly as I say. I think that's absolutely fine. I'm not going to castigate. I think this is a paper tiger argument. Now explain to me how pressure support is going to work on these patients.
So, you know, if the patient is awake enough to, you know, trigger their breath, then theoretically pressure support is more comfortable. They can drive the ventilator. They can determine how long the breath is and so on and so forth. And I think every once in a while, you know, you do encounter these patients who are kind of awake and able to trigger the ventilator. So pressure, you know, support would basically just put them in control of the vent. And it could make them more comfortable and it could allow you to decrease the amount of sedation that you're giving them. Now, one thing to be aware of is that the ventilators that I'm using are extremely sophisticated. They're almost like microcomputers in a way. So it is impossible to smother a patient with this ventilator. If the patient stops breathing or if their, you know, minute ventilation falls, it'll kick into auto, you know, backup mode immediately. And it's actually really irritating when I'm trying to do like pressure support trials. The vent just keeps on kicking into backup mode.
Sure. I guess my trepidation is, and I might have to think this through a little bit more, is the termination of that pressure support may be terminated before I'd like. That's why I'm more comfortable with a pressure control mode, that the patient could still trigger at their leisure. I mean, I'd almost rather put them on SIMV pressure control than pressure support, because the flow termination seems like it may be altered by the fact that the patient does have bronchospasm and may not have their capability of getting out as much breath. You know, the machine would really have to be set just perfectly to not have flow termination happen. What do you think about that? This is just what occurs to me. I never really thought this through enough.
Yeah, no. I mean, you may need to adjust how the flow cycles off. I have done this a couple times and it wasn't a big issue, but yeah, that is an issue. If there's expiratory flow, flow limitation, the vent might misinterpret the way the patient's triggering the vent.
Because I could see an asthmatic that's intubated for other reasons who just happens to have a little bit of bronchospasm. I'm sure pressure support is fine. When I'm talking about this, I'm talking solely about the patient who had such bad asthma they need to be intubated, which is a very, that's even more of a subset of crashing asthmatics. And in those patients, in general, I usually keep them pretty sedated for the first few hours, and I'm doing all the work. And then, like you say, when they break, and then I don't think it matters as much what you do anyway.
I 100% agree, and I think the confusion arises in that we're talking about two different subsets of patients. When you first intubate the patient, you're going to deeply sedate them. You don't want them triggering the vent. You want them passive on the vent. The place where I have used this, and I think it could potentially have a role, is like once the patient breaks in like day two or day three, they're doing better. Maybe they're not quite ready to come off the vent. Maybe there's something else going on, or, you know, whatever, they're getting a procedure or something. At that point, it might be more comfortable. And honestly, I really love pressure support as just a maintenance mode in general. I think it's comfortable and allows us to use less sedation. So that's kind of what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about like the, you know, peri-death asthmatic.
That makes complete sense. I completely agree with you. And I think, and your post, you've spoken about it a few times, and I hope you speak about it some more. I think we're underutilizing pressure support as a primary ventilatory mode. And there was that big trial that was published where they were very early putting the patients on pressure support. Was it one of the recruitment trials? You'd know better than me, Josh. I'm trying to remember. It was by day two. Oh, no. It was the low tidal volume. It was the one that said we could actually go up to 10 mLs per kg, the 8 to 10 group. You might know the eponym or the acronym. I'm blanking. It was the one that compared.
Vent.
Yeah. Was it Provent?
Yeah.
Provent actually had them by day two in almost every patient in both groups on pressure support. And I think if you want to look for a trial that says this is a very utile mode that is safe and efficacious, that's the trial to look at. The Provent trial. I hope they subgroup it out of the efficacy of pressure support as a primary ventilatory mode after like that first 24 hours. I think that's probably the best thing we're not doing in a lot of places.
100% agree. And especially, you know, with end tidal monitoring and all these other things, you know, the patient isn't going to suddenly hypoventilate and explode.
Absolutely. I mean, even the not super cool ventilators, I think everything past the 1980s have backup settings such that even if the patient just totally bagged on their ventilations, they're not going to get they're not going to get apneic. They're not even going to get significantly hypercarbic. It takes over way before that when their ventilation gets low. All right, Josh, is there anything I missed? I think I hit most of it.
No, I think we're really basically in agreement on this. There's one other crazy idea that I'm planning to pull out in the IBCC chapter, which I think you're going to disagree with.
Okay, I can't wait. should this be on the recording, or should we let people wait for the IBCC chapter?
I'll leave it up to you how you want to edit it.